day, Shinji heard the startling news that Yasuo too was going to serve an apprenticeship on the Utajima Maru. The story went that Yasuo had not at all relished the idea of becoming a rice rinser and had been forced to agree only when Uncle Teru declared that the apprenticeship had to come before any betrothal to Hatsue. When Shinji heard this, his heart was filled with anxiety, pain, and then, at the same time, hope. Together with his mother, Shinji went to Yashiro Shrine to pray for a safe voyage and to obtain a charm. The day of departure had come. Accompanied by the captain, Shinji and Yasuo boarded the Kamikaze Maru for the ferry crossing to Toba. A number of people came to see Yasuo off, including Hatsue, but there was no sign of Terukichi. Shinji was seen off by no one but his mother and Hiroshi. Hatsue did not look in Shinji's direction, but just as the boat was about to sail, she whispered something to Shinji's mother and handed her a small package. The mother gave it to her son. Even after he was on the boat, Shinji had no chance to open the package, as the captain and Yasuo were with him. He gazed at the receding outline of Utajima. And as he did so, he became aware of his own feelings for the first time. Here he was, a young man born and bred on that island, loving it more than anything else in the world, and yet he was now eager to leave it. It was his desire to leave the island that had made him accept the captain's offer of a berth on the Utajima Maru. Once the island was out of sight, the boy's heart became peaceful. As he had never been on his daily fishing trips, he was now free of the thought that tonight he would have to return to the island again. "I'm free!" he shouted in his heart. This was the first time he had ever realized there could be such a strange sort of freedom as this. The Kamikaze Maru sailed on through a drizzling rain. Yasuo and the captain stretched out on the straw mats in the passenger cabin and went to sleep. Yasuo had not spoken to Shinji once since they had boarded the ferry. The boy pressed his face close to one of the round portholes across which the raindrops were running and by its light examined the contents of the package from Hatsue. It contained another charm from Yashiro Shrine, a snapshot of Hatsue, and a letter. The letter read, "Every day from now on, I'll be going to Yashiro Shrine to pray for your safety. My heart belongs to you. Please take care of yourself, and come back safe and sound. I'm enclosing my picture so I can go voyaging with you. It was taken at Cape Daio. About our voyage, Father hasn't said a word to me, but I think he must have some special reason for putting both you and Yasuo on his ship. And somehow, I think I can see a ray of hope for us. Please, please, don't give up hope. Please keep on fighting." The letter encouraged the boy. Strength filled his arms, and the feeling that life was worth living flooded through his entire body. Yasuo was still asleep. By the light from the porthole, Shinji studied Hatsue's photograph. In it, the girl was leaning against one of Cape Daio's huge pines, and a sea breeze was blowing her skirts, whirling about inside her thin white summer dress, caressing her bare skin. And his courage was still further revived by the thought that he too had once done just what the wind in the photograph was doing. Reluctant to take his eyes off the picture, Shinji had propped it up on the edge of the rain-blurred porthole and had stared at it for a long time, when behind it there slowly moved into view the outline of Toshi Island to port. Once again, the boy's heart lost its peacefulness. But the strange way in which love can torture the heart with desire was no longer a novel thing for him. It had stopped raining by the time they reached Toba. Dull silver rays of light shone down from between rifts in the clouds. Among the many small fishing boats in Toba's harbor, the 185-ton Utajima Maru stood out conspicuously. The three jumped down onto its deck, which was sparkling in the sunshine after the rain. Raindrops were still running, gleaming down the white-painted masts, and the imposing booms were folded down over the hatches. The crew had not yet returned from shore leave. The captain led the two boys to their quarters, an 8-mat cabin next to the master's quarters and directly over the kitchen and mess hall. Other than the lockers and a small central space covered with thin straw matting, there was nothing except two sets of two-tiered bunks on the right and, on the left, one set of bunks and a separate bunk for the chief engineer. Several photographs of movie actresses were stuck to the ceiling like charms. Shinji and Yasuo were assigned to the first tier of bunks on the right. The chief engineer, the first and second mates, the bosun, the seaman, and the firemen all slept in this one small cabin, but as they alternated the watches, there were always bunks enough to go around at any one time. After showing them the bridge, the master's quarters, the holds, and the mess hall, the captain left them to rest in the crew's cabin. Left alone in the cabin, the two looked at each other. Yasuo felt downhearted and decided to make peace.
"Well, here we are at last, just the two of us, to be friends. A lot of things happened on the island, but let's forget about them and be good friends from now on."
Shinji gave a grunt of agreement and smiled.
Toward evening, the crew returned to the ship. Most of them were from Utajima and were known by sight to Shinji and Yasuo. Still smelling of liquor, they all teased the newcomers. Then the two of them were instructed in the daily routine and assigned their various duties. The ship was to sail at 9 a.m. Shinji was given the task of taking the anchor light off the mast at the first crack of dawn the next morning. The anchor light was very much like the night shutters of a house ashore. Turning it off meant that the ship was awake, just as opening the night shutters means a house is awake. Shinji scarcely closed his eyes all night and was up before the sun the next morning, taking down the anchor light as things began to turn gray. The morning was wrapped in a misty rain, and the street lamps of Toba ran in two straight lines from the harbor to the railway station. The thick-throated whistle of a freight train sounded from the direction of the station. The boys scrambled up the naked mast over the furled sails used for auxiliary power. The wood was wet and cold, and the rocking motion of the faint waves that lapped the ship's sides was transmitted directly to the mast. In the first rays of the morning sun, wet with mist, the anchor light was a hazy milk-white color. The boy reached up for the hook. As though it disliked being taken down, the anchor light gave a big swing. The flame flickered inside the drenched glass, and a few drops of water fell into the boy's upturned face. Shinji wondered what port they would be in when he next took down this light.
The Utajima Maru, on charter to the Yamagawa Transport Company, was to carry lumber to Okinawa and return to Kobe in about 6 weeks. After sailing through the Kii Channel and calling at Kobe, the ship sailed westward through the inland sea and had its quarantine inspection at Moji. It then proceeded southward along the eastern coast of Kyushu and received its sailing clearance at the port of Nichinan in Miyazaki Prefecture, where there was a customs office. The ship then called at the harbor of Fukushima, at the southern tip of Kyushu. There it took on a cargo of 14,000 cubic feet of lumber. After leaving Fukushima, the Utajima Maru became in fact a sea-going vessel and was handled as such. It was due to reach Okinawa in about 2 or 2.5 days. When there was no work to be done with the cargo, or during their rest periods, the crew would loll about on the thin straw matting that covered the 3-mat space in the center of the quarters and listen to a portable phonograph. There were only a few records, and most of them were so worn out that they produced only dingy music through the scratching of a rusty needle. Without exception, they were all sentimental ballads concerning ports or sailors, fog or memories of women, the Southern Cross or liquor or sighs. The chief engineer was tone-deaf and never succeeded in his efforts to learn at least one tune during a voyage, always forgetting what little he had memorized before the next voyage. Whenever the ship would pitch or roll suddenly, the needle would go sliding across the record, leaving another scratch in its wake. Often at night, they would sit up late arguing ridiculous points. Such subjects as love and marriage, or whether the human body can take as large an injection of salt as of dextrose, were sufficient to keep them talking for hours. The person who maintained his point with the most stubbornness usually won in the end, but the reasoning of Yasuo, who had been president of the Young Men's Association on the island, was so logical that it even won the respect of his elders. As for Shinji, he always sat silent, hugging his knees and smiling as he listened to the others' opinions. "There's no doubt but what the boy's a fool," the chief engineer once told the captain. It was a busy life aboard the ship. From the moment the newcomers got up, there were always decks for them to clean or some other of their numerous odd jobs to be performed. It gradually became abundantly clear to the crew that Yasuo was lazy. His attitude was that it was enough just to go through the motions of performing his duties. Shinji, however, covered up for him and even did part of Yasuo's work, so this attitude of his did not become immediately apparent to his superiors. But one morning, the bosun, finding Yasuo loafing in the cabin after having stolen away from his deck-cleaning duties on the pretext of going to the head, lost his temper and berated him roundly. Yasuo gave a most ill-considered reply. "Oh well, anyway, when this voyage is over, I'm going to become Uncle Teru's son. Then this ship will belong to me." The bosun was in a rage, but he prudently held his tongue, telling himself it just might turn out the way Yasuo said. He never again scolded Yasuo to his face, but from his whispered words, the other men soon learned what the insubordinate youngster had said, and the result was all to Yasuo's disadvantage rather than otherwise. Shinji was extremely busy, and the only chance he had to look at Hatsue's picture was a brief moment each night before going to bed or when he was on watch. He never let anyone else so much as set eyes on the picture. One day, when Yasuo was bragging about being adopted by Terukichi as Hatsue's husband, Shinji took what was for him a most unusually devious means of revenge. He asked Yasuo if he had a photograph of Hatsue. "Sure I have," Yasuo replied immediately. Shinji knew without a doubt that this was a lie, and his heart was filled with glee. A few moments later, Yasuo spoke very nonchalantly. "Do you have one too?" he asked.
"Have one what?"
"A picture of Hatsue."
"No, I don't have one."
This was probably the first deliberate lie Shinji had ever told in his life. The Utajima Maru arrived at Naha. After clearing quarantine, it entered the harbor and discharged its cargo. It was forced to lie at anchor 2 or 3 days, waiting and waiting for permission to enter the closed port of Unten, where it was to load scrap metal for the return voyage to Japan. Unten was on the northern tip of Okinawa, where the American forces had made their first landing in the war. Since the crew were not allowed ashore, they spent their time staring from the deck out at the desolate barren hills. The Americans had burned down every tree on the hills when they landed, fearing unexploded mines. The Korean War had come to an end for the time being, but in the crew's eyes, the island still had a most unusual air. From morning to night, there was the droning thunder of fighter planes practicing, and countless vehicles, gleaming in the sun of a tropical summer, were constantly moving back and forth along the broad, paved highway that bordered the harbor. Sedans and trucks and various military vehicles. Beside the road, the prefabricated houses for families of American military personnel were aglint with the color of new cement, while the patched tin roofs of the battered native houses were ugly blotches on the landscape. The only person who went ashore to get the agent for Yamagawa Transport to send a chandler was the first mate. At last, the permit to enter Unten was received. The Utajima Maru entered the port and took on its cargo of scrap. They had just finished when the report came that Okinawa was in the path of a threatening typhoon. Hoping to escape the typhoon by sailing as quickly as possible, they cleared port early the next morning. Then all the ship had to do was lay its course straight for Japan. That morning, a light rain was falling. The waves were high and the winds southwesterly. The hills quickly vanished from view behind them, and the Utajima Maru sailed on by compass for 6 hours with very poor visibility. The barometer fell steadily and the waves became still higher. The atmospheric pressure reached an abnormal low. The captain decided to return to Unten. The rain was blown to mist by the wind, visibility had gone down to absolute zero, and the 6 hour run back to port was extremely difficult. Finally, the hills of Unten were sighted. The bosun, who was quite familiar with these waters, stood on lookout in the bow. The harbor was enclosed by about 2 miles of coral reef, and the channel through the reef, not even marked with buoys, was most difficult to navigate.
Stop! Go! Stop! Go!
Checking its headway countless times and then moving ahead very slowly, the ship passed through the channel between the coral reefs. It was then 6 o'clock in the evening. One Bonito ship had taken shelter within the reefs. Fastening themselves together with several ropes, the two ships proceeded side by side into Unten's harbor. The waves in the harbor were low, but the wind grew always stronger. Still side by side, the Utajima Maru and the Bonito ship threw out 4 lines each, 2 hawsers and 2 cables, tying their bows to a buoy the size of a small room, and prepared to ride out the storm. The Utajima Maru had no radio equipment, depending solely upon its compass. So the radio operator on the Bonito ship passed on to them every report he received concerning the typhoon's development and course. When night came, the Bonito ship put out a deck watch of 4 men, and the Utajima Maru put out a 3-man watch. Their duty was to watch the hawsers and cables, as one could never be sure they might not snap at any moment. There was also the uneasy feeling that the buoy itself might not hold. But the danger of snapping lines was much the greater. Fighting the wind and the waves, the watch courted death many times to keep the ropes wet with salt water, fearing they might fray if they became too dry in the wind. By 9 o'clock that night, the two ships were beset by a wind with a speed of 56 miles an hour. An hour before midnight, Shinji and Yasuo and one of the young seamen took the watch. Their bodies were hurled against the wall as soon as they began crawling out onto the deck. The wind-whipped rain struck their cheeks as though it were needles. It was impossible to stand upright on the deck, which rose up like a wall before their very eyes. Every timber of the ship was creaking and rumbling. The waves in the harbor were not quite high enough to sweep the decks, but the spray of the waves, blown on the wind, had become a billowing mist, shrouding their vision. Crawling along the deck, the three finally reached the prow and clung to the bits there. The 2 hawsers and 2 cables that secured the ship to the buoy were tied to these bits. They could see the buoy dimly about 25 yards away in the night, just barely revealing its white-painted existence through the pervading darkness. And when, to the accompaniment of the creaking of the cables, which was like shrieks, a huge mass of wind would strike the ship and lift it high into the air, the buoy would fall far below them into the blackness and seem all the smaller. The three looked at each other's faces as they clung to the bits, but they did not speak, and the salt water striking their faces made it all but impossible for them even to keep their eyes open. The neighing of the wind and the roar of the sea, surprisingly enough, gave the infinite night that enveloped them a quality of frenzied serenity. Their job was to keep their eyes riveted on the lines tying the Utajimaru to the buoy. Stretched taut, the hawsers and cables drew the only indomitably straight lines across a scene in which everything else was pitching and rolling with the gale's madness. The way they stared fixedly at these rigidly drawn lines created in their hearts a feeling akin to confidence, born of their very concentration. There were times when it seemed as if the wind had suddenly stopped, but instead of reassuring them, such moments made the 3 young men shiver with terror. Instantly, the huge mass of wind would come crashing again, rattling the yard arms and thrusting the atmosphere aside with a tremendous roar. The three continued their silent watch over the lines. Even above the sound of the wind, they could hear intermittently the shrill and piercing creaking of the lines.
"Look!" Yasuo cried in a thin voice.
One of the cables wrapped around the bits was rasping ominously. It seemed to be slipping a little. The bits were directly before their eyes, and they perceived an extremely slight but sinister alteration in the way the lines were wrapped about the bits. At that instant, a length of cable came recoiling out of the darkness, flashing like a whip, and hit the bits with a snarling sound. They had dodged instantly, just in time to escape being slashed by the severed cable, which had force enough to have cut them to the bone. Like some living thing that takes long in dying, the cable writhed about in the darkness of the deck, making a shrill noise. Finally, it came to rest in a semicircle. When they finally grasped the situation, the three young men turned pale. One of the four lines tying the ship to the buoy had given way, and no one could guarantee that the cable and two hawsers that remained might not give way also at any moment.
"Let's tell the captain," Yasuo said, moving away from the bits.
Searching for handholds as he went creeping along, being thrown off his feet many times, Yasuo groped his way to the bridge and made his report to the captain. The burly captain remained calm, or at least gave the outward appearance of doing so.
"I see. Well, then, let's just use a lifeline. The typhoon passed its peak at 1 o'clock, so there's no danger at all in using a lifeline now. Someone can just swim out to the buoy and tie the lifeline to it."
Leaving the second mate in charge of the bridge, the captain and the chief mate followed Yasuo back. Like mice tugging at a rice cake, they rolled and dragged a lifeline and a new marlin along with them step by step from the bridge to the bow bits. Shinji and the sailor looked up at them inquiringly. The captain stooped over them and shouted to the three youths in a loud voice,
"Which one of you fellows is going to take this lifeline over there and tie it to that buoy?"
The roaring of the wind covered the youth's silence.
"Don't any of you have any guts?"
the captain shouted again. Yasuo's lips quivered. He pulled his neck down into his shoulders. Then Shinji shouted out in a cheerful voice, and as he did so, the white flash of his teeth shone through the blackness to prove that he was smiling.
"I'll do it,"
he shouted clearly.
"Good! Go ahead!"
Shinji rose to his feet. He was ashamed of himself for the way he had been squatting on the deck until now, practically cowering. The wind came attacking out of the black reaches of the night, striking him full in the body, but to Shinji, accustomed to rough weather in a small fishing boat, the heaving deck on which his feet were firmly planted was nothing but a stretch of earth that was frankly a bit out of sorts. He stood listening. The typhoon was directly above the boy's gallant head. It was as right for Shinji to be invited to a seat at this banquet of madness as to a quiet and natural afternoon nap. Inside his raincoat, the sweat was running so profusely that both his back and chest were drenched. He took the raincoat off and threw it aside. As he did so, his barefoot figure, wearing a white t-shirt, loomed through the blackness of the storm. Under the captain's directions, the men tied one end of the lifeline to the bits and the other end to the marlin. Hindered by the wind, the operation progressed slowly. When the ropes were finally tied, the captain handed the free end of the marlin to Shinji and yelled into his ear,
"Tie this around your waist and swim for it. When you reach the buoy, haul the lifeline over and make it fast."
Shinji wrapped the marlin twice around his waist above his belt. Then, standing in the bow, he stared down at the sea. Down beneath the spray, down beneath the whitecaps that beat themselves to pieces against the prow, there were the jet-black, invisible waves, twisting and coiling their bodies. They kept repeating their patternless movements, concealing their incoherent and perilous whims. No sooner would one seem about to come rising into sight than it would drop away to become a whirling, bottomless abyss again.
At this point, there flashed across Shinji's mind the thought of Hatsue's photograph in the inside pocket of his coat hanging in the crew's quarters. But this idle thought was blown to bits upon the wind. He dived from the prow of the ship. The buoy was about 25 yards away. Despite his great physical strength, which he was confident would have to yield to none, and despite, too, his ability to swim around his home island 5 times without stopping, still, it seemed impossible that these would suffice to get him across the immensity of those 25 yards. A terrible force was upon the boy's arms. Something like an invisible bludgeon belabored them as they tried to cut a way through the waves. In spite of himself, his body was tossed on the waves, and when he tried to bring his strength into opposition to the waves and grapple with them, his movements were as useless as though he were trying to run through grease. He would be certain that the buoy was finally within arm's reach, and when he rose up out of the trough of the next wave, he would look for it and find it just as far away as ever. The boy swam with all his might, and inch by inch, step by step, the huge mass of the enemy fell back, opening the way for him. It was as though a drill were boring its way through the hardness of solid rock. The first time his hand touched the buoy, he lost his hold and was pulled away. But then by good luck, a wave swept him forward again, and just as it seemed on the point of dashing his chest against the iron rim, lifted him up with a single sweep and deposited him on the buoy. Shinji took a deep breath, and the wind filled his nostrils and mouth to the choking point. At that instant, it seemed to him that he could never breathe again, and for a time he even forgot the task he was supposed to perform. The buoy rolled and pitched, surrendering its body open-heartedly to the Black Sea. The waves ceaselessly washed over half of it, pouring off with great commotion. Lying face down so as not to be blown off by the wind, Shinji started untying the line from around his waist. The knot was wet and difficult to loosen. When it was finally untied, he began pulling the marlin. Now, for the first time, he looked toward the ship. He could see the forms of the 4 men clustered about the bow bits. The men on watch in the bow of the Bonito ship also were gazing steadily in his direction. Although only a scant 25 yards away, everything seemed exceedingly distant. The black shadows of the 2 moored ships were rising together, side by side, high into the air, and then sinking back into the waves again. The thin marlin offered little resistance to the wind and was comparatively easy to haul in, but soon a heavy weight was added to its end. It was the lifeline, almost 5 inches thick, which he was now pulling. Shinji was all but thrown forward into the sea. The wind resistance against the lifeline was very strong, but at last the boy had one end of it in his hands. It was so thick that even one of his big hands would not go entirely around it. Shinji was at a loss as to how to apply his strength. He wanted to brace himself with his feet to pull, but the wind would not permit that posture. And when he heedlessly applied all his strength to the rope, he was all but dragged into the sea. His drenched body was at fever heat, his face burning hot, and his temples were throbbing violently. He finally managed to wind the lifeline once around the buoy. Then the operation became easier. The line provided him with a fulcrum for his strength, and now for a change he could support his body with the thick line. He wound the line once more around the buoy and then proceeded methodically to tie it fast. He waved his arms to announce the successful completion of the job. He could plainly see the 4 men on the ship waving their arms in reply. The boy forgot how exhausted he was. His instinct for cheerfulness reasserted itself, and flagging energy welled up anew. Facing into the storm, he inhaled his fill of air and then dived into the sea for the return trip. They lowered a net from the deck and hoisted Shinji aboard. Once the boy was back on deck, the captain clapped him on the shoulder with a huge hand. Although Shinji was ready to faint with fatigue, his masculine energy still maintained him. The captain had Yasuo help Shinji to his quarters, and the men who were off duty wiped him dry. The boy fell asleep the moment he was in his bunk.
No noise the storm could make could have disturbed that deep sleep. The next morning, Shinji opened his eyes to find brilliant sunshine falling across his pillow. Through the round porthole in his bunk, he looked out at the crystal-clear blue sky that followed the typhoon's departure, at the view of bald hills under a tropical sun, at the glitter of a placid, undisturbed sea. Chapter 15. The Utajima Maru returned to Kobe several days behind schedule. So by the time the captain and Shinji and Yasuo reached the island, where they were to have returned before mid-August in time for the Lunar Calendar Lantern Festival, the festivities were already over. They heard the news of the island while being ferried across on the Kamikaze Maru. A huge turtle had come ashore on Five League Beach a few days before the Lantern Festival and had been quickly killed. There were more than a basket full of eggs in it, which had been sold for 2 yen apiece. Shinji went to worship at Yashiro Shrine to give thanks for his safe return and then on to Jukichi's, where he had been immediately invited for a celebration. Over the protests of the boy, who never drank, his sake cup was filled many times. 2 days later, he once again went out fishing on Jukichi's boat. Shinji had not said anything about his voyage, but Jukichi had heard all the details from the captain.
"I hear you did a great thing."
"Oh, no." The boy blushed a little, but had nothing further to say. Anyone unfamiliar with his personality might easily have concluded that he had spent the last month and a half off sleeping somewhere. Jukichi was silent a while and then spoke in an offhand way.
"Have you heard anything from Uncle Teru?"
"No."
"Oh."
No one made any mention of Hatsue, and Shinji, feeling no great loneliness, threw himself into the old familiar work while the boat rocked in the rough seas of the dog days. The work fit both his body and soul perfectly, like a well-tailored suit, leaving no room for the intrusion of other worries. The strange feeling of self-sufficiency did not leave him all day. At dusk, he saw the outline of a white freighter sailing far out at sea, and it was different from that he had seen on that day so long ago, but once again, Shinji felt a new emotion. "I know where that ship is bound for," he thought. "I know what sort of life they live aboard it, what sort of hardships they have. I know everything about that ship." At least, the white ship was no longer a shadow of the unknown. Instead, there was that about the distant white freighter, trailing its long plume of smoke through the late summer dusk, that quickened his heart even more than had the unknown. The boy felt again in his hands the weight of that lifeline he had pulled with the last ounce of his strength. With these strong hands, he had certainly once actually touched that unknown at which he had previously stared from a great distance. He had the sensation that now, by simply stretching out his hand, he could touch that white ship out at sea. On a childish impulse, he held his five big knuckled fingers out toward the sea to the east, already thick with the shadows of evening clouds. Summer vacation was half over, and still Chiyoko did not come home. The lighthouse keeper and his wife waited day by day for their daughter's return to the island. The mother wrote an urgent letter. No reply came. She wrote again. 10 days later, there was a grudging answer. Giving no reason, Chiyoko simply wrote that she would not be able to come back to the island during this vacation. The mother finally decided to try tears as a means of persuasion and sent a special delivery letter of more than 10 pages, pouring out her feelings and begging her daughter to come home. A reply came when only a few days remained of vacation and a week after Shinji's return to the island. It was a reply which the startled mother had never dreamed of. In her letter, Chiyoko confessed how she had seen Shinji and Hatsue coming down the stone stairs, arm in arm, that day of the storm, and how she had then landed the two of them in great difficulties by the uncalled-for act of running to Yasuo with the tale.
Chiyoko was still tormented with feelings of guilt, and she went on to say that unless Shinji and Hatsue finally found their happiness, she herself would be too ashamed ever to come back to the island. If her mother would act as a go-between and persuade Terukichi to let them get married, this was the condition she set for her return to the island. This tragic, demandingly badgering letter sent chills up the kind-hearted mother's spine. She was struck with the thought that, unless she took appropriate steps, her daughter, unable to bear the pangs of conscience, might even commit suicide. From her wide reading, the mistress of the lighthouse recalled various frightening instances of adolescent girls who had killed themselves over some equally trivial matter. She decided not to show the letter to her husband, the lighthouse keeper, and told herself that every day counted, that by herself she would have to manage everything at once in such a way as to bring her daughter home as quickly as possible. As she changed into her best clothes, a suit of white cambric, there was reborn within her the meddlesome feeling of years gone by when, as a teacher in a girls' high school, she was on her way to complain to some parent about a problem student. Straw mats were spread out in front of the houses along the roadside leading down into the village, and on them there were sesame and red beans and soybeans drying in the sun. The tiny green sesame seed, washed by the late summer sun, cast their miniature, spindle-shaped shadows one by one across the coarse straw of the fresh-colored mats. From here, one could look down upon the sea. The waves were not running high today. As the mother descended the steps that formed the main street of the village, her white shoes made light sounds against the concrete. Then she began to hear lively, laughing voices and the springy sound of wet clothes being beaten. She drew nearer the sounds and found a half-dozen women in house dresses doing their laundry by the side of the stream bordering the road. Shinji's mother was one of the group. After the lantern festival, the diving women had more leisure, going out only occasionally to gather edible seaweed, so they turned then to an energetic washing of the accumulation of dirty clothes. Using almost no soap, they one and all would spread the laundry over flat rocks and trample it with their feet.
"Why, hello, mistress. Where are you on your way to today?"
They all bowed and called out their greetings. Beneath their tucked-up skirts, the water reflections were playing over their dark thighs.
"I just thought I'd drop by Terukichi Miyata-san's place a minute."
As she made this reply, it occurred to her that it would be strange to meet Shinji's mother this way and then, without so much as a word to her, proceed on to arrange for her son's engagement. So she turned and started down the precipitous flight of slippery, moss-covered stone steps that led from the road to the stream. Her shoes made the descent perilous, so, turning her back to the water, but stealing many a glance over her shoulder, she backed slowly down the steps on all fours. One of the women, standing in the middle of the stream, reached out and lent her a helping hand. Reaching the bank, she took off her shoes and began to wade across. The women on the farther bank stood watching her hazardous progress with blank amazement. She caught hold of Shinji's mother's sleeve and made a clumsy attempt at private conversation, whispering words into her ear that everyone around could plainly hear.
"Maybe this isn't quite the place, but I've been wanting to ask how things have gotten on for Shinji-san and Hatsue-san lately."
The suddenness of the question made the other's eyes grow round, and she said nothing.
"Shinji-san likes Hatsue-san, doesn't he? Well, and still Terukichi-san is standing in the way, isn't he? Well, that's what the trouble is, all right, but, and how does Hatsue-san feel about it?"
At this point, the other divers, who could not have helped overhearing, broke into the private conversation. Where talk of Hatsue was concerned, all the divers without exception had become her staunch defenders ever since that day when the peddler had held the contest. They had also heard the whole true story from Hatsue herself and were one and all against Terukichi.
"Hatsue, she's head over heels in love with Shinji too.
That's the plain truth of it, mistress.
And yet, would you believe it, that Uncle Teru is planning to marry her to that good-for-nothing Yasuo?" Have you ever heard of such foolishness? Well, that's that, said the mistress of the lighthouse, as though addressing a classroom of students. Today I received a threatening letter from my daughter in Tokyo, saying she didn't know what she might do if I wouldn't help get the two married. So I'm on my way to have a talk with Terukichi-san, but I thought I ought to stop and find out how Shinji-san's mother felt about it first. Shinji's mother reached down and picked up her son's sleeping kimono, which she had been treading clean beneath her feet. Slowly, she proceeded to wring it out, gaining time for thought. Finally, she turned to face the mistress of the lighthouse and bowed her head low. "I'll greatly appreciate anything you can do," she said. Moved by a spirit of helpfulness, the other women went into noisy conclave with each other, like a flock of waterfowl beside a river, and decided that if they went along too, as representatives of the women of the village, the show of strength might help awe Terukichi. The mistress of the lighthouse agreed, so the five of them, not including Shinji's mother, wrung out their washing hurriedly and ran to take it home, arranging to meet at the bend of the road leading to Terukichi's house. The mistress of the lighthouse stood just inside the gloomy earthen-floored room of the Miyata house. "Good day," she called in a voice still youthful and steady. There was no answer. The other five women stood just outside the door, their sunburned faces thrusting forward like so many cactus leaves, their eyes glittering with enthusiasm as they peered into the dark interior. The mistress of the lighthouse called out again, her voice echoing emptily through the house. Presently, the staircase gave a squeak, and Terukichi himself came down wearing an underdress kimono. Hatsue was apparently not at home.
"Why? It's Mistress Lighthouse Keeper,"
Terukichi grumbled, standing imposingly on the threshold leading up from the earthen floor. Most visitors at this house felt the urge to flee when received by this perpetually inhospitable visage with its bristling mane of white hair. The mistress herself was daunted, but she drummed up courage to continue. "There's something I'd like to talk with you about for a minute."
"So? All right, please come in."
Terukichi turned his back and promptly went up the stairs. She followed him, with the other five women tiptoeing after her. Terukichi led the way into the inner sitting room upstairs and, without further ceremony, took the seat of honor in front of the alcove for himself. His face revealed no great surprise when he noticed the number of visitors in the room had grown to six. Ignoring them all, he looked toward the open windows. His hands were toying with a fan showing a picture of a beautiful woman advertising a drugstore in Toba. The windows looked out directly over the island's harbor. There was only one vessel inside the breakwater, a boat belonging to the cooperative. Far in the distance, summer clouds were floating over the Gulf of Ise. The sunshine outdoors was so brilliant that it made the room seem dark. On the alcove wall, there hung a calligraphic scroll done by the last governor but one of Mie Prefecture, and beneath it, gleaming with a luster like that of wax, there were an ornamental rooster and its hen, their bodies carved out of a knotty and gnarled root of a tree, and their tails and combs formed from the natural growth of the slender shoots. The mistress of the lighthouse sat at this side of the bare rosewood table. The other five women, having mislaid somewhere their courage of a little while before, now sat primly just in front of the bamboo blind hanging in the entrance to the room, as though they were giving an exhibit of house dresses. Terukichi continued looking out the window and did not open his mouth. The sultry silence of a summer afternoon came upon them, broken only by the buzzing of several large blue bottle flies that were flying about the room. The mistress of the lighthouse wiped the sweat from her face several times. At long last, she began to speak.
"Well, what I want to talk to you about is your Hatsue-san and the Kubo family's Shinji-san and..."
Terukichi was still looking out the window. After a long pause, he spoke, seeming to spit out the words.
"Hatsue and Shinji?"
"Yes." Now, for the first time, Terukichi turned his face toward her, and then he spoke without so much as a sign of a smile.
If that's all you have to talk about, it's all already settled. Shinji's the one I'm adopting for Hatsue's husband.
There was a stir among the women as though a dam had burst, but Terukichi went right on speaking, paying not the slightest heed to his visitor's reaction.
But in any case, they're still too young, so for the time being, I've decided to leave it at an engagement, and then, after Shinji comes of age, we'll have a proper ceremony. I hear his old lady isn't having too easy a time of it, so I'll be willing to take both her and the younger brother in, or, depending upon how it's finally decided, help them out with some money each month. I haven't said anything to anybody about all this yet, though. I was angry at first, but then after I made them stop seeing each other, Hatsue became so out of sorts that I decided things couldn't go on that way. So I decided on a plan. I gave Shinji and Yasuo berths on my ship and told the captain to watch and see which one of them made the best showing. I let the captain tell all this to Jukichi as a secret, and I don't suppose Jukichi has told Shinji even yet. Well, anyway, to make a short story of it, the captain really fell in love with Shinji and decided I'd never be able to find a better husband for Hatsue. And then when Shinji did that great thing in Okinawa, well, I changed my mind too and decided he was the one for my girl. The only thing that really counts...
Here, Terukichi raised his voice emphatically.
The only thing that really counts in a man is his get-up-and-go. If he's got get-up-and-go, he's a real man, and those are the kind of men we need here on Utajima. Family and money are all secondary. Don't you think so, Mistress Lighthouse Keeper? And that's what he's got, Shinji. Get-up-and-go.
Chapter 16. Shinji could now visit the Miyata house openly. One night, after returning from fishing, he called Hatsue's name from the front door. He was wearing freshly laundered trousers and a clean white sport shirt, and from each hand there dangled a big red snapper. Hatsue was ready and waiting. They had made a date to go to Yashiro Shrine and the lighthouse to announce their engagement and express their thanks. The dusk in the earthen-floored room became lighter when Hatsue entered. She was wearing the light summer kimono with large patterned morning glories on a white background that she had bought on that occasion from the peddler, and its whiteness was brilliant even at night. Shinji had been leaning against the door waiting, but when Hatsue came out, he suddenly looked down, waved one clog-shod foot as though to drive away insects, and mumbled, "The mosquitoes are terrible."
"Aren't they, though?"
They went up the stone stairs leading to Yashiro Shrine. They could have easily run up them at a single breath, but instead, their hearts filled to overflowing with contentment, they ascended slowly, as though savoring the pleasure of each separate step. When they reached the 100th step, they paused as though reluctant to end this happy climb by going on to the top. The boy wanted to hold her hand, but the red snappers prevented him. Nature, too, again smiled on them. When they reached the top, they turned around and looked out over the Gulf of Ise. The night sky was filled with stars, and as for clouds, there was only a low bank stretching across the horizon in the direction of the Chita Peninsula, through which soundless lightning ran from time to time. Nor was the sound of the waves strong, but coming regularly and peacefully, as though the sea were breathing in healthy slumber. Passing through the pine grove, they reached the unpretentious shrine and stopped to worship. The boy was filled with pride by the loud and clear sound his formal handclap made, ringing out far and wide. So he clapped his hands again. Hatsue had bowed her head and was praying. Against the white background of her kimono collar, the nape of her sun-tanned neck did not look particularly white, and yet it charmed Shinji more than the whitest of white necks could have done. In his heart, the boy reminded himself again of his happiness. The gods had indeed given him everything he had prayed for. They prayed for a long while.
and in the very fact of their never once having doubted the providence of the gods, they could feel that providence around them. The shrine office was brightly lit. Shinji called out, and the priest came to the window. Shinji's words were rather vague, and for a while the priest could make neither head nor tail of what the two had come about. But at last he understood, and Shinji presented him with one of the red snappers as their offering to the gods. Receiving this splendid gift from the sea, the priest was reminded that presently he would be officiating at their wedding rites. He congratulated them heartily. Climbing the path through the pine grove behind the shrine, they again savored the night's coolness. Though the sun was completely set, the cicadas were still singing. The path leading up to the lighthouse was steep. One of his hands was now free, so Shinji held the girl's hand. "Me?" said Shinji. "I'm thinking I'll take the exam and get a first mate's license. You can after you're 20, you know."
"Oh, that'd be wonderful.
If I got my license, I guess it'd be all right to have the wedding then." Hatsue made no reply, but only smiled shyly. They rounded Woman's Slope and approached the residence of the lighthouse keeper. The boy called out his greetings, as always, at the glass door, where they could again see the mistress's shadow moving about as she prepared supper. The mistress opened the door. There in the darkness she saw the boy and his betrothed standing hesitantly.
"Oh, here you both are, and welcome,"
the wife called out in a loud voice, finally taking in both hands the large fish that was thrust out to her. Then she called back into the house.
"Father, here's Shinji-san with a fine red snapper for us."
Taking his ease in one of the inner rooms, the lighthouse keeper called back without getting up.
"Thanks as always. And this time it's congratulations, too. Come on in, come on in."
"Please do come in," the mistress added. "Tomorrow Chiyoko's coming back, too."
The boy had not the slightest idea of all the emotions he had aroused in Chiyoko, nor of the mental anguish she had experienced because of him, and he heard the mother's abrupt remark without attaching any significance to it. Having been almost forcibly made to stay for supper, they stayed on for nearly an hour longer, and then it was decided that the lighthouse keeper would show them around the lighthouse on their way home. Hatsue, having only recently returned to the island, had never seen the interior of the lighthouse. First, the lighthouse keeper showed them the watchhouse. To reach it from the residence, they walked along the edge of the small vegetable garden where radishes had been planted just the day before, and climbed a flight of concrete steps. At the top, there was the lighthouse, standing back against the mountain, and the watchhouse at the edge of the cliff that fell to the sea. The beacon of the lighthouse, like a shining column of fog, was sweeping from right to left across the top of the watchhouse gable on the side facing the sea. The lighthouse keeper opened the door of the watchhouse and, preceding them, turned on a light. They saw the drafting triangles hanging on a window frame, the scrupulously tidy desk with its log for recording ship's movements, and, on a tripod facing the windows, the telescope. The lighthouse keeper opened a window, adjusted the telescope, and lowered it to the right height for Hatsue. Hatsue took one look through the telescope, stopped, and wiped the lens with her kimono sleeve, looked again, and gave a shout of joy.
"Oh, beautiful!"
Then, as Hatsue pointed to the lights in various directions, Shinji picked them out with his phenomenally keen eyes and explained them to her. Keeping her eye to the telescope, Hatsue pointed first to the scores of lights dotting the sea to the southeast.
"Those?
They're the lights of the dragnet boats. They come from over in Aichi Prefecture." It seemed as though each of the vast number of lights out over the sea found its counterpart somewhere among the vast number of stars in the sky. Directly opposite was the beam from the lighthouse on Cape Irako. Behind it were scattered the lights of the town of Cape Irako, and to the left, the lights of Shino Island were faintly visible. At their extreme left, they could see the Cape Noma Lighthouse on the Chita Peninsula. To its right were the clustered lights of the port of Toyohama. That red light in the middle, that was the light on the port's breakwater. And far to the right, there flickered the aircraft beacon on top of Mount Oyama. Hatsue gave a second cry of admiration. A large ocean liner had just come into the field of the telescope. It was scarcely visible to the naked eye, but as the ship made its stately way across the telescope's field of view, its delicate reflection was so splendid and clear that the boy and girl compromised by taking turns at the telescope. It seemed to be a combined cargo and passenger ship of 2,000 or 3,000 tons. In a room off the promenade deck, they could plainly see several tables spread with white cloths and a number of chairs. Not a single person was visible. The room was apparently the dining salon, and as they were examining its walls of white asphalt tile, suddenly a white-uniformed steward entered from the right and passed in front of the windows. Presently the vessel, carrying green lights at bow and stern, passed out of the telescope's range and sailed away through the Irako Channel, bound for the Pacific. The lighthouse keeper took them next to the lighthouse itself. On the ground floor, the electric generator was making a rumbling noise, surrounded by the odor of oil. Oil cans, oil lamps, and tins of oil. Ascending the narrow spiral staircase, they found, housed in a small and lonely round room at the top, the source of the lighthouse's light, living its life away in silence. Looking from the window, they watched the beam of light making its vast sweeps from right to left across the black, clamoring waves of the Irako Channel. Tactfully, the lighthouse keeper went back down the spiral staircase, leaving the two of them alone there. The small round room at the top of the tower was enclosed in walls of polished wood. Its brass fittings gleaming, the thick glass lens revolved leisurely around the 500-watt electric bulb, magnifying this source of light to 65,000 candle power and maintaining a speed that produced a constant series of flashes. Reflections from the lens moved around the circular wooden wall and, to the accompaniment of the squeak, squeak, squeak revolving sound characteristic of lighthouses built before the turn of the century, these same reflections played across the backs of the boy and his betrothed, who had their faces pressed against the window. They felt their cheeks so close together that they could touch at any moment, felt too the flaming heat of each other's cheeks. Out in front of them stretched the unfathomable darkness, where the beam from the lighthouse was making its vast, regular sweeps. And the reflections of the lens kept circling around inside the little room, their patterns disrupted only at the spot where they crossed the backs of the white shirt and the flower-patterned kimono. Once again it came to pass that Shinji, little given to thinking as he was lost in thought. He was thinking that in spite of all they'd been through, here they were in the end, free within the moral code to which they had been born, never once having been estranged from the providence of the gods. That in short, it was this little island, enfolded in darkness, that had protected their happiness and brought their love to this fulfillment. Suddenly, Hatsue turned to Shinji and laughed. From her sleeve, she took out a small pink shell and showed it to him. "Remember this?"
"I remember."
The boy flashed his beautiful teeth in a smile. Then from the breast pocket of his shirt, he took out the snapshot of Hatsue and showed it to her. Hatsue touched the picture lightly with her own hand and then returned it. Her eyes were full of pride. She was thinking it was her picture that had protected Shinji. But at this moment, Shinji lifted his eyebrows. He knew it had been his own strength that had tided him through that perilous night.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of The Sound of Waves, written by Yukio Mishima. Narrated by Brian Nishi. Executive Producer, Kristen Lang. Producers, Mike Charzik and Stefan Rudnicki. Directed and engineered by Cassandra DeCure. Edited by Ted Scott. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 1956 by Alfred A. Knopf, Inc. Copyright renewed 1984 by Meredith Weatherby. Originally published in Japan as Shiosai. Production copyright 2010 by Audible Inc.